you can trust, choose Kim. Visit kimpurcell.ca today for more information.
Hello and welcome to The Corridor here on CFRC 101.9 FM in Kingston, Ontario, and podcasting on Spotify and Apple Music. I'm Dinah Jansen, and with me is CFRC Local Journalism Initiative news producer Jesse Bell. This regional news program features news from Kingston and area provided by local and regional journalists through the support of the Local Journalism Initiative and the Community Radio Fund of Canada. Welcome and enjoy. Welcome to The Corridor, brought to you by Realtor Kim Purcell of Sutton Group Masters Realty. Connect with Kim today to find a new home tomorrow via kimpurcell.ca. I'm Dinah Jansen, and with me is CFRC's Local Journalism Initiative producer Jesse Bell and CFRC's Arts Coordinator Genevieve Hinch. Our top story is from CFRC's Local Journalism Initiative reporter Era McCauley, covering an update on the proposed Alto High-Speed Rail line.
Hello, I'm Era McCauley, Local Journalism Initiative reporter for CFRC 101.9 FM in Kingston, Ontario. Coming up are some of the top news stories in Kingston and the Islands. You can listen to CFRC's news programs Today on YGK and Kingston Currents on Mondays, Wednesdays, and Thursdays at 5 p.m. or subscribe to our podcasts on Spotify and Apple Music. If you have any Kingston news tips you'd like to share, you can reach out to our news team at news@cfrc.ca. On June 22nd, Alto President and CEO Martin Imbleau released the What We Heard report alongside Stephen McKinnon, Minister of Transport and the leader of the government in the House of Commons. The report, which was published online and delivered at a press conference in Kingston, took into account public feedback gathered during the first phase of Alto High-Speed Rail's consultation process, including conversations with Indigenous communities along the Toronto-Quebec City corridor and concerns from agricultural producers, landowners, and rural communities related to impacts on and access to rural property.
Over 100 days between January and April, we conducted consultations to deepen our understanding of the corridor. We made a deliberate decision to engage early and before key decisions were made. That means that we did not have all the answers. We wanted to meet people and to listen first. We did not want to show up with a predetermined alignment. It could have been faster, but it would not have been appropriate for what comes next. 10,000 people attended the open houses, Minister said it, 300,000 people online, that is historical. We also conducted meetings with the Indigenous communities. We had meetings with 30 of the communities, and what we did was a critical step. And throughout the first consultation period, a few key themes arised consistently. Of course, land acquisition, protection of agricultural land, environmental impacts, quality of life, and these concerns will directly inform the next phase of our planning. Agricultural land was our major focus. At the end of April, very recently, we put our commitment on paper. First, we want to minimize the impact. We want to prioritize the agreements from a willing seller, willing buyer with the farmers, provide a fair compensation, and ensure access will be maintained while supporting long-term productivity of the farmers.
Minister McKinnon had this to say.
We have heard how popular this project is, but also about important considerations, and yes, concerns that many Canadians have. And I want to acknowledge those concerns. I want to acknowledge those fears. I want to say to those who are in the agricultural sector, those who own land, we understand. I come from a farming family myself. We understand how attached people are to their farms, to their land, to their heritage, to their legacy. And I have directed Alto to proceed with extreme sensitivity, to respectfully deal with landowners who will end up along this route, this 60 meter wide corridor that has to, in most cases, travel in a straight line, because high speed rail does not like curves. But we will proceed with the least possible impact on people's properties, with the least possible and least intrusive impact possible on our natural environment. And Canadians want us to do that as well. We will not cut corners when it comes to respect. We will not cut corners when it comes to sensitivity.
Following a review of the report, Minister McKinnon directed Aalto to develop a plan to assess a southern route option between Peterborough and Ottawa that included a potential stop in Kingston with Via Rail service integration.
But one of the other things that has become very clear to us, hence our presence here today, is how strongly the people of Kingston and this area feel about being included. And today, I'm pleased to be able to say, we heard you. We also heard from those in Cornwall, in Gananoque, Napanee, in Belleville, Trenton, Cobourg, Port Hope, and yes, even Oshawa, who also want to be connected to this incredible network. So we are formally asking Aalto to develop a plan to assess a southern route option between Peterborough and Ottawa that includes a stop in Kingston that would interconnect, yes, interconnect with Via Rail services, subject to technical feasibility and project requirement.
The plea for Kingston was consistent, strategic, well-organized, and definitely preliminary analysis showed that a stop in Kingston could have a positive impact on ridership. And as the minister said it, a big portion of the population would be within 20, 25 minutes of a train station, which will be transformational.
Mayor Patterson was on hand to share his enthusiasm for the project as well.
We, of course, are very encouraged and excited by the potential to have a high-speed rail stop here in Kingston, and very excited by the potential to be able to have a hub that would link in with Via Rail, being able to connect this entire region, the province and beyond, with both conventional and high-speed rail. There's been a lot of conversation about high-speed rail, obviously, in our community and across the region over the last number of months, and I think of particularly one comment that a resident shared with me, that he'd done the numbers, and he said, you know, that on a per capita basis, the Kingston is probably the most successful rail-oriented community in the entire country. And I think it's very fitting and exciting that Kingston can, and I think very much should, play a role in the future of what that rail infrastructure should look like. Whatever is going to be built to improve rail infrastructure, we want to be a part of it, and we want to help support it. As has already been said, we have so many national and regional institutions here in Kingston, Queen's University, Royal Military College, St. Lawrence College, we have Kingston Health Sciences Center, we have CFB Kingston, and of course a diverse and growing private sector as well. And so it's never been more important for our community for people to be able to get to and from here and across the region, and we think that this is a really positive and encouraging step forward on that front.
Kingston City Council has since signed a non-disclosure agreement, NDA, with Aalto as part of the development of the high-speed rail line through the region, which has sparked concerns with the Aalto HSR Citizen Research Initiative, who had petitioned the city not to sign the agreement and is now saying, quote, "The objection is not that confidential material was shared confidentially. It is that information was withheld until silence was promised, that access to the facts was made conditional on a commitment not to use them. It is now on the city's own account, a description of Kingston." A city spokesperson explained that the NDA applies to all city staff and councillors and was needed for the city to receive any technical information from Aalto. The Citizen Research Initiative rejected this claim, noting that the bargain Kingston accepted, silence in exchange for information, was offered on the premise that there was no alternative. Two neighboring counties declined it, and one of them proceeded to put the promoter's own material on the public record. The alternative existed, and Kingston did not take it, and it is not explained why. The counties referenced are Stormont, Dundas, Glengarry, and United Counties of Prescott and Russell, whose councils turned down the requests in June and May, respectively. Last week, Transport Action Canada, a nonprofit citizen-based organization that promotes sustainable transport and functions as a consumer-based advocacy group, sent a letter to Minister McKinnon and issued a press release outlining their support for the Kingston stop, with some concerns. In their press release, TAC notes that it has had a decades-long history of advocating for high-speed rail in the Quebec-Windsor corridor, including providing input on various proposals that have preceded Aalto. While pleased with the concept in principle, TAC says they are cautious about fully endorsing the project unless the stop in Kingston is closely integrated with the existing Via Rail station, arguing a stop at the proposed southern alignment, a 25 to 30-minute drive north of Kingston, would significantly harm the the high-speed rail's ability to connect effectively with Via Rail services. According to Aalto, it is expected that the high-speed rail would reduce travel times between Kingston and Toronto to approximately 90 minutes. Current travel times on Via Rail range from 2 hours and 19 minutes to 2 hours and 45 minutes. Aalto states that inclusion on their HSR route would establish Kingston as a key regional mobility hub, improving connections and placing up to 80% of residents between Peterborough and Ottawa within a 25-minute drive of a station. According to a city council report that was sent to the minister to plead Kingston's case for the stop on the route, Kingston is Via Rail's fourth busiest station.
Plus, between St. Lawrence, Queens, and RMC, you have an additional 35,000 students who regularly travel back and forth to other cities. And you're already a hub for regional connectivity with the fourth busiest Via Rail station in Canada. I was amazed to read that statistic. One that serves as a key anchor in a proven and robust rail culture.
While connections with Via Rail services are considered integral to the high-speed rail's successful integration into the public transport landscape by Transport Action Canada, they flagged Via Rail's poor track record for on-time services, which they argue must be addressed if the government wants to instill confidence in constituents that Aalto can meet its service goals. They call for improvements to the current regulatory and operational framework governing access to Metrolinx, a Government of Ontario agency created to improve the coordination and integration of transportation in the GTA and Hamilton, and CN infrastructure, as well as clear federal leadership to address persistent dispatching delays, infrastructure bottlenecks, and access arrangements. It is quite hard, they say, to make a competitive connection when one service can regularly be expected to be 30-plus minutes late. According to a quarterly report released by Via Rail in 2025, on-time performance fell sharply from 72% in Q1 2024 to just 30% in the first quarter of 2025, something they blamed on what they called arbitrary operational restrictions imposed by CN Rail in the Quebec City to Windsor corridor, leading to longer travel times and reduced service reliability. Transport Action Canada says it remains optimistic and broadly supportive of the project and hopes that, much like in the case of a Kingston stop, the government remains open to constructive input to deliver a much-needed service to Canadians.
We do not approach this work with anything other than a lot of respect for the work that needs to get done, for overcoming the doubts that people may have, but also to continue building the great excitement that Canada can be a home for high-speed rail, something we arguably should have done decades ago. But we are beginning in earnest today.
Thank you, Era. Coming up next, we have Dinah Jansen reading a story from the local journalism initiative reporter for YGK News, Sarah Beavis, that covers the influx of funding to build a school in Westbrook.
Thank you, Jesse. The City of Kingston announced Friday that the Limestone District School Board will build a new elementary school in Westbrook to help meet growing demand driven by residential development and urban expansion. The project is part of a $1.6 billion provincial investment supporting 79 school projects across Ontario. LDSB has received $21.4 million in provincial funding to build a school that will accommodate over 400 students. In September 2025, Kingston City Council submitted an application to the Ministry of Education for a new school building in the Westbrook neighborhood. Limestone District School Board Chief Executive Officer and Director of Education Krishna Burra gave a statement to YGK News about the importance of a new elementary school in Westbrook. According to a report presented to City Council by Watson and Associates economists in 2024, Kingston West will see the most population growth in the next 25 years of any neighborhood in the city. Loyalist Cataraqui Councillor Paul Chaves, whose district includes Westbrook, explained the growing demand for schools in the area. Councillor Chaves also described the condition of the current school in Westbrook, W.J. Holsgrove Public School, and the need for a new elementary school. Holsgrove School is busting at the seams in regard to the number of students they have, said Councillor Chaves. The City of Kingston is proposing a land exchange in which the new school will be built in the Westbrook Park, and the site of W.J. Holsgrove Public School would become a new park. MPP of Kingston and the Islands Ted Hsu hopes the new school can keep up with the growing demand in the Kingston's northwest area. Hsu believes that the recently constructed Catholic school in the West End neighborhood of Woodhaven-St. Genevieve is already at capacity and continues to grow. grow. While further details and construction timelines have yet to be announced, the City of Kingston and the Limestone District School Board will host an information session for community members in the fall.
Thank you to Dinah Jansen and Sarah Beavis for that story. Coming up next, we have a story from the LJI reporter for CJAI Amherst Island Radio, Ted Evans, about the suspension of Greater Napanee's grass-cutting program.
Hi, I'm Ted Evans, local journalism initiative reporter and news director at CJAI Amherst Island Radio, 101.3 FM in Stella, Ontario. Coming up are some of the top news stories from Loyalist Township. You can hear Amherst Island Radio's news program, North Shore News, on 101.3 Amherst Island Radio or online at cjai.ca. For showtimes throughout the week, check the schedule on our website at cjai.ca. Greater Napanee Council has unanimously decided to suspend a grass-cutting order until staff can review the bylaw and bring back more information. Staff will be looking to differentiate between neglected lawns and naturalized lawns in the bylaw. Mayor Terry Richardson explained the process will likely involve public consultation.
We at the Town of Greater Napanee have recognized that the bylaw that we have should be updated. We have updated a vast amount of bylaws, a vast amount of processes and policies over the past 2.5 years. The lawn cutting bylaw is one that we do need to address. We do need to update it. And we've just run out of time. And it's going to require, I think, probably an awful lot of public consultation, because for every conversation that we have, there's someone on the other side of the conversation that says, well, what about this and what about that? So I know it's one of those things that's high on the priority list. So rest assured, we will look at it. It's an issue that the municipality has recognized. It's just a timing thing.
Richardson spoke about concerns regarding lawn grass.
It's very well known that the black-legged tick in eastern Ontario, specifically in long areas of Lake Ontario, they're very, very prominent, and probably a good portion of those ticks do carry the Lyme disease. Most recently in the news, we've heard about the Lone Star tick. I guess the concern with the long grass is the first of all, for me anyways, is the tick problem, because of the prominent tick problem that we have in eastern Ontario. It should be a concern.
CAO Matthew Grant spoke about the work staff would be doing in the meantime.
I think staff can come back and talk about what a review process would look like. I think that this would require reasonable amounts of public consultation. One of the number one complaints we get in bylaw services is unkept lawns. So we could take a look at the experience of others. We could provide options at that time. Because, of course, whatever we would recommend would be something that would be extrapolated out to the broader community. So 1 month's time to be able to put that together, I think, is a reasonable ask. And until such time, I'm happy to tell bylaw to suspend the order.
Residents came forward to ask council to suspend the grass cutting order while they update their bylaw. Resident Austin Lloyd spoke about issues with the current bylaw.
I believe Greater Napanee's grass-cutting bylaw served our community well when it was written 25 years ago, but horticulture and environmental science has changed, and I believe our bylaws changed too. I want to be clear, I'm not suggesting that people should be allowed to abandon their properties. Public safety, neighborhood appearance, and respect for neighbors matters. Vegetation should never block sidewalks, roads, intersections, traffic signs, hydrants, or spill into neighboring properties. Naturalized landscapes should still have maintained edges, clear pathways, and appropriate setbacks. There is an important difference between neglected property and an intentionally managed landscape. Right now, I don't think our bylaw clearly recognizes that difference.
Lloyd noted more modernized bylaws that other communities across Ontario are adopting.
Burlington recognizes naturalized landscapes that are deliberately planted, regulated, and regularly maintained. Belleville also allows naturalized gardens while continuing to require proper maintenance, setbacks, and removal of noxious weeds. These communities haven't lowered their standards. They've modernized them.
Resident Julie Bogdanowicz tends to two properties on Dorland Drive and received an order to comply with grass cutting. Bogdanowicz invited council to view her properties, and councilors who did noted the importance of naturalized lawns and removing noxious weeds. Bogdanowicz explained what a new bylaw could focus on.
Many municipalities in Ontario have modernized and fine-tuned their bylaws. And so instead of a bylaw requiring the removal of tall grass, a bylaw can speak to the health and safety and the removal of noxious plants. And I know firsthand how cities can evolve and modernize their bylaws to be more specific about health, safety, and sustainability.
Councillor Bob Norrie spoke about viewing Bogdanowicz's properties and updating the bylaw.
My wife and I Sunday drove out here. The noxious weeds are gone, which being on Quinty Conservation, I've learned a lot about. It doesn't have to be a pristine garden of flowers. This was quite something to see. So I really think we have to rethink this, because maybe people with backyards like where I live near the hospital might want to have it looking like that. You know, make it more for the butterflies than that.
Councillor Bill Martin spoke about what the new bylaw might look like.
That's what we really want to get to, is noxious weeds, not whether somebody's got a naturalized lawn. So, I mean, I really think we need to amend our bylaw to accept the fact that one size doesn't always fit all. The order to mow, I think, should be suspended until staff can look at the bylaw. And I think there should be an appeal process put in there if somebody gets an order to do whatever, whether it's mowing or whatever, there should be an appeal process.
Richardson spoke about bylaw enforcement in the meantime.
Bylaw enforcement is an extremely difficult job to do at times. So I know that they're trying to use, or I think that they've tried to use some form of discretion in order to find some type of resolution so that we can at least keep peace in the neighborhood, I guess is the best way to put it.
Staff will be coming forward with more information for council at their next meeting, August 28th. For Amherst Island Radio and the Local Journalism Initiative, I'm Ted Evans.
Thank you to Ted Evans for that story. Now over to Genevieve Hinch with a story from Keith Dempsey, LJR reporter for the Brockville Recorder and Times, about first quarter gaming revenue payments in Gananoque and the township of Leeds and the Thousand Islands.
Thank you, Dinah. The Ontario Lottery and Gaming Corporation, OLG, has issued first quarter gaming revenue and payments of $221,901. Each of the town of Gananoque and the township of Leeds and the Thousand Islands for hosting Shoreline Casino's Thousand Island. The payments will cover the period from April 1st to June 30th, the first quarter of the fiscal year, and represent an increase from the $185,356 each municipality received from the previous quarter of Jan 1st to March 31st. Since what is now known as Shoreline Casino's Thousand Islands opened in June 2002, Gananoque and the TLTI have each received $34,681,993 through OLG's Municipal Revenue Sharing Program, officials at the agency said. The stronger first quarter payment follows a year in which annual gaming revenue continues its long-term decline. During OLG's 2025 to 2026 fiscal year, each municipality received $873,544, down from the approximately $938,000 the previous fiscal year. While the latest quarterly payment signals an improvement from the previous quarter, annual casino revenues remain well below historical highs. In the early 2010s, Gananoque and the TLTI each received more than $1.8 million annually, more than double the amount received in 2025 to 26. Municipal officials have previously acknowledged casino revenues are unlikely to return to those peak levels and emphasized the importance of diversifying municipal revenue sources rather than relying heavily on gaming payments. Gaming hosting payments are calculated using a province-wide generated formula based on gaming revenue at each site. According to OLG, host communities across Ontario have received more than $2.4 billion in non-tax gaming revenue since 1994. The corporation said all of its profits are reinvested in the province, with municipal hosting payments supporting local infrastructure, community services, and economic development.
Thank you to Genevieve Hinch and Keith Dempsey for that story. Now over to Jesse Bell with the Kingston Sports Report, brought to you by CFRC Power Plays.
This is part three of your OUA football season preview brought to you by CFRC Power Plays. Today we're looking at the ninth place team from 2025, the Waterloo Warriors. A team touched by tragedy, the Waterloo Warriors showed a great deal of will and skill in 2025. A scrappy unit with some outstanding athletes in all three phases, the Warriors showed flashes of brilliance last year in narrow losses to Ottawa and Carleton. They upended the Varsity Blues on a last-second field goal to tally their first win of the season, before turning in a respectable effort in the Battle of Waterloo against Laurier. They faced Queens in their homecoming game, and that's when everything changed for the program. Late in the second quarter, starting quarterback Nick Orr was knocked out of the game by a hit from Justin Pace. This hit, which resulted in a lengthy suspension for Pace, had immense consequences for Orr, who may never play football again. The Warriors would rally around their injured quarterback and score one final win against the York Lions to finish 2-6 on the year. Honestly, pretty remarkable given the circumstances. Let's take a look at their 2025 stats. They did finish 11th in the conference in points for with 137, that's about 17 points per game. They were 10th in yards per game with 359 and finished with 2,720 yards, also 10th in the conference. They were 8th in total pass yards with 1,901, and they were 6th in total rush yards with 969, about 121 per game. Not too bad. Now defensively, they did finish 9th in points allowed with 283, but this is a defense that is better than the stats would indicate. They were actually 4th in passing yards allowed per game with 263, and 9th in rush yards allowed per game with 168.8. They finished 6th, so right in the middle, in total yards allowed per game, but once again, I think this defense is better than the numbers indicate. In terms of point differential, they were last in the conference with a minus 146, largely because their offense, which once again dealt with some pretty major injuries, just couldn't string together consistent scoring drives, but I don't think that's indicative of where this team actually was. Over the last five seasons, in 2021, they had a 3-3 record, the final year of quarterback Trey Ford. In 2022, 1-7. 2023, bounce back year, finishing 3-5. 2024, 0-8, although I will say they were one of the better 0-8 teams I ever watched. And in 2025, they finished 2-6. So, a lot of up, a lot of down, but I do think the program is trending in the right direction. Looking ahead to 2026, well, there are a lot of departures for the Warriors. Running back Quinton Springer, who I thought was one of the better players on offense, period, for them, has transferred to their crosstown rivals at Laurier. Wide receiver Romel Samuel Slocum is gone. Running back Anthony Miller, a long-standing Warrior, is gone. Backup quarterback Nolan Caban is done. Nick Orr, as we touched on, is likely out for the season. Thankfully, Waterloo does have a new generation ready to step up on offense, including quarterback Emmett Ward and running back Roy Vanderveen, who was an unquestioned bright spot for the Warriors last season. They also have the outstanding linebacker Michael Omoseni back, and I love watching Omoseni play. He is so fast, so instinctive, just a fantastic defensive player. The Warriors do have a tough 2026 schedule ahead of them. They play the Ottawa teams back-to-back before traveling to Kingston for what will surely be an emotionally charged rematch with the Gales. That's Queen's home opener. The Warriors have tough games against Laurier in the Battle of Waterloo, Windsor, and Guelph before closing things out with McMaster and York. And I do think Waterloo could beat McMaster, but I am going to give the Marauders the benefit of the doubt this year. I've got Waterloo going 1-7, but finishing in 9th ahead of York and Toronto.
And thank you to Jesse Bill for that update, and also thank you to our sponsor. Today's edition of The Corridor is brought to you by Kim Purcell of Sutton Group Masters Realty. Learn more about Kim and local listings for your new home via kimpurcell.ca. Coming up, we have the CFRC Environment Canada weather forecast for the Kingston region.
This is your Environment Canada weather report for the Kingston region. Tuesday, August 4th. 27 is your high, feeling a degree warmer with a UV index of 8, mostly sunny with a few clouds here and there. Wednesday, August 5th, 25 is your high with cloudy and humid conditions, feeling closer to 30 degrees. Thursday, August 6th, 27 is your high, but with the humidity it feels closer to 30, and once again we've got a UV index of 8. Friday, August 7th. 26 degrees is your high with largely sunny conditions, feeling closer to 27, so a little cooler. Beautiful day here in the city of Kingston. Saturday, August 8th, 25 is your high with a 55% chance of precipitation in the morning, going to feel closer to 30 degrees otherwise and quite humid. Sunday, August 9th, 25 is your high, feeling closer to 30, partly sunny, with a 70% chance of afternoon thunderstorms. And starting off next week, Monday, August 10th, 25 is your high, with a 55% chance of precipitation.
And that's a wrap for this week's edition of The Corridor, supported by the Local Journalism Initiative and the Community Radio Fund of Canada. Don't forget to visit CFRC.ca for the latest in local and regional news headlines, concert and events listings, and more. You can also follow CFRC on Facebook and Instagram at CFRC Music and on Twitter X at CFRC. You can support CFRC and its independent news programming by donating via CFRC.ca. We'll be back next week with more in local and regional news. Thank you for joining us. Thank you for listening to this podcast produced at CFRC 101.9 FM at Queen's University in Kingston, Ontario, situated on the traditional territories of the Anishinaabe and Haudenosaunee peoples, and brought to you by the generous support of Smith Engineering.
When it comes to Kingston real estate, local experience matters. Kim Purcell is an award-winning realtor born and raised in Kingston with over a decade of experience and 100 five-star reviews. If you want honest advice and results you can trust, choose Kim. Visit kimpurcell.ca today for more information.
This is a rebroadcast. Please disregard any reference to dates or times.
Hello, and welcome to Grad Chat, your opportunity to find out about graduate research here at Queen's. My name is KM on the FM, and I'm your host for this week's Grad Chat. A show like this could not happen without the support of the School of Graduate Studies and Postdoctoral Affairs and CFRC, so a big thank you to both of them. If you miss the show at any time, you can download the podcast the next day on either iTunes, Google Podcast, Spotify, or CFRC Podcast. It's a great way to stay informed about all of the exciting research our graduate students and postdocs are working on. Today, I'd like to introduce you to Hannah Burrows, who's doing a PhD in psychology under the supervision of Dr. Valerie Kuhlmeier. Welcome to Grad Chat, Hannah.
Well, thanks so much for having me.
Well, thank you so much for coming on the show, and I'm really excited to dive into your research because it sounds super cool. But before we get into it, can you tell us a little bit about what attracted you to Queen's in the first place?
That's a great question. I've been here forever. People say I'm like the ancient Queen's person in our department, but I did my undergraduate research here, my master's work, and now my PhD.
Okay, very nice.
So I definitely started off being attracted to Queen's. I grew up in Ottawa, but from the research perspective, there were so many opportunities in the psychology department that made me really excited. My first thesis was in autism and ADHD, and I worked in the autism spectrum disorders lab, and I just fell in love with the research process. It was so stimulating, and I got to actually work with dogs in my third year with the First Many Dogs Project, which is a global consortium of researchers across the world doing the same research, trying to figure out the differences in culture across different dog-human populations. And from there, I was like, I need to study dogs. This is amazing. I can't believe I get paid to do this. It's awesome.
So your research currently is understanding dog-human relationships by linking guardian beliefs with real-time dog-guardian behavior to improve animal welfare and everyday interactions. Can you tell us a little bit more about what that looks like, what that means?
Yeah, so I guess I could backtrack a little bit to just describe my master's work. Yeah. So it kind of laid the foundation for what I want to do in my PhD. So first thing I did, I developed a survey, which is called PUPS.
That's great.
Yeah, thank you so much. A lot of iterating just on that part of the research, but it stands for the Perception of Undesirable Pet Behavior Survey. So a lot of the work that's been done in dogs prior is not super naturalistic, and it doesn't really generalize when we're looking at how people perceive their dogs and if that's a self-fulfilling prophecy or not to the types of behavior that show up in the different areas that you are. So our idea was looking at how can we first contextualize it? Mm-hmm. So if I have an issue with my dog and I tell someone I have a bad dog or my dog is poorly behaved, it doesn't really tangibly provide a great example for a person that can help you in that situation.
Mm-hmm.
So the idea with this research was sort of looking at, okay, we can survey people. And through the survey, what did we get, right? Like, mm-hmm. what are those areas where we can work on our dog's behavior, but also be more cognizant as the person that probably is impacting it a little bit more mm-hmm. than even the dog, right? It's a bit of a self-fulfilling prophecy. So we ended up finding four different areas. So it was like public behaviors, training behaviors, fear and distress or anxiety, and then home-related behaviors. Mm. And from this, I actually had a two-part study basically for my master's. With the pups research, we were able to take the pups into real life. So when you're approaching a difficult situation, say there's food on the ground and you don't want your dog to eat it, what actually happens?
Mm-hmm.
So that was the second portion. We had people come into the lab and we did actual like real-time behavioral data. And that was what basically like started all of our interest around this.
Mm-hmm. And then with your PhD work, where are you headed now with this project?
Yeah, so based on this, some of the findings we found that are pretty interesting that I want to dive into a little bit more are there's different beliefs that obviously predicted different guardian behaviors. So the guardians who are actually more worried or fearful about their dog's behavior, regardless of however the dog acted, were actually more likely to disengage when they actually needed to like provide context or scaffolding for the dog to understand why the behavior was bad or not.
Mm.
So that's super interesting. Mm-hmm. It could be its whole like side study if we wanted to do that. And another one was looking at dogs of more concerned guardians actually spent more time monitoring the food. So they actually spent like less time sort of like looking at their guardian or like watching them attentively. Mm. So there's some training implications there, which I'm really interested in. And it's a bit of a segue into what I want to do for my PhD, which is working with working dog populations.
Mm.
So there's so many different types of like working dog relationships, like there's endangered species detection. Mm. So some people go and train dogs to collect scat, and then we can use that scat so we don't have to actually capture endangered species and understand the dynamics ecologically of those populations. I'm really interested in working with more applications that have to do with like seeing guide dogs, police work. We just did a really big survey in our lab, which is over 500 police dog trainers and handlers across the world.
Wow.
And looking at what they need us researchers to provide them. And really interesting research questions that came out of that paper as well. So excited to dive into those things.
Okay, so you've got lots of avenues on the go for your PhD, it sounds like, and all about understanding that human-dog relationship or dog-guardian relationship. Is that looking, like you mentioned working dogs, but your master's work was with pets as well, right? So you're looking at both pets and dogs who are working, but might be pets in their downtime, I guess, is how to say that.
Yeah, and like I think people think, especially in a North American context, like our relationship with dogs is obviously very different in a Western cultural context. Also, like primarily we call it like weird in psychology, where it's like Western, like educated, industrialized. So there's, I think it's around like 20% or something of the global dogs in the world are companion animals, and the rest are also wild.
Mm.
So there's also like really interesting implications for like wild dog research that I really want to look into as well. Like there's different contexts, like for example, in Bali, there's like kind of this like middle ground between like a companion versus a working dog where like the dogs kind of just coexist with people. And they had a really bad feral dog population sort of problem where a lot of the dogs were really sick.
Mm.
But within their culture there, a lot of the offerings people would provide every morning ended up being more things the dogs could eat rather than just food that they had left out that maybe made dogs sick. And people were a little bit more responsive to that. And now I think they're almost at like 90% of dogs there that are like completely healthy.
Wow.
Which is like totally just a mindset of like a cultural change in a different environment. So yeah, there's really interesting like the differences between companion animals and working dogs. Mm-hmm. But I'm really, my thing is looking at like how we can best teach people to understand dogs and how can that work in a working context, but also completely transferable to a companion animal.
Oh, that's really cool. Because I mean, like you said, in the kind of a Western, a weird setting, as they call it, dogs are everywhere. So
yeah,
there's a lot of applications or potential applications for your work. What originally drew you to studying dog and human relationships?
Yeah, so I briefly mentioned this, but I'll totally shout out Many Dogs because mm-hmm. I think it's a really cool thing. So I'm not sure how much you're aware of the replication crisis that happened in psychology, mm-hmm. but it's been like a couple decades now of people trying to replicate, not really seeing this, like, I would say, like, seminal research papers that have been published, and people kind of saying, oh, I don't know how much we're really, how much this is transferable across different cultures or contexts, for example. So there's been this global movement of, like, the Many, Many Project.
Okay.
So there's, like, many babies, many otters, many dogs. And the first Many Dogs study was near the end of my undergrad, so very, very new research. Mm-hmm. But I got to actually take part in that, which was really cool. So our lab collected data, and I'm pretty sure there was something like 30 labs across the world, and we all did the same study. And then we all looked at, like, what are the differences there? Mm-hmm. Because ultimately, like, there's a lot of places doing the same research, which is amazing. Mm-hmm. But then we're publishing findings that, like, can be contradictory or just may not really replicate across different samples, but we're saying they're generalizable.
Mm.
So it's, like, really helping people hold ourselves accountable as researchers, mm-hmm. which I find really awesome. And getting to do that work, I really... It's basically that project is looking at how do dogs respond to cueing and how we point. Because they have a really specific, really interesting way of, like, communicating with people, much better than a lot of different species.
Mm.
So that project, I was like, oh my God, this is awesome. Basically, my job was just holding a dog and, like, telling them to move around. And I was like, this cannot be research. Like, I feel very lucky. So as a dog person myself, I got really excited in it and wanted to keep doing it.
And then that led to your master's work. And now you're continuing to expand that in your PhD work.
Yes.
Yes. Okay.
Yeah, completely.
And you mentioned this already about kind of how it's going to build a little bit on some of the work you've already done. Could you tell us a bit more, like, specifically about how your PhD research is going to build on your master's research? Like, you did two studies in your master's. Are you planning a few studies in your PhD? Like, what will it look like?
Yeah, so I wanted to shout out Dr. Tom Hollenstein, who's in the psych department. His work is specifically looking at developmental research, so between, like, usually dyadic stuff, which is totally, like, person-dog or dog for me, but he does, like, maternal-child sort of conflicts and things like that. So he has developed and really honed this methodology called the state-space grid.
Okay.
So it's a way to visualize, like, the places that people get stuck in conversationally in terms of, like, do you really stick in this area? Where's the pain point between these two people? And there's a lot of really cool quantifiable ways to look at it. So this method also provides a visual view of it, which is pretty cool because then you can see, like, also what you're describing. It's never been used with animals before.
Okay.
So what we're trying to do at the moment is taking my master's work and trying to decipher how to put that into a state space grid so we can visually see, like, where do dogs and people get hung up on when they're in this sort of challenging situation? Mm. And can we pinpoint those parts? And with dogs especially, like, obviously there's a power dynamic compared to two humans having a conversation. But it'll be interesting to see, like, how much, kind of that helicopter parenting approach. Like, if I have this view of my dog before I go into a situation, and am I proactively impeding my dog from interacting and learning in a way that I also think might be helping them? And can we, like, actually visually see, like, okay, at 30 seconds in this interaction, that's when you didn't really provide your dog the context to move forward or understand or learn from the situation? So that's the first step with that. And then trying to take that tool into hopefully, like, a veterinarian context or a working dog context, or when we select dogs for different training, for example, like PTSD with veterans. There's so many places that, like, we use dogs as tools, really, but we don't really look at, like, how to best train or really select from the person side and the dog side.
Ah, okay, yeah.
Yeah.
So from the state space type of method, when you were describing your master's work with dogs approaching food and then seeing how that would go, would that look something like, I mean, this is all ideal once you've mapped it on the method, but it would be like, okay, we see, say, an anxious guardian who's already worried about their dog eating something they found in this context, in a research context, but, you know, they found on a walk or something, and they start to you know, at 15 seconds, they start to tense up. And at 20 seconds, the dog realizes and then also starts to look more at the food instead of the person. Or is that the kind of thing that you would be able to map 100%. Using this state space method? Okay.
Yeah. I think the other cool thing is, like, that's totally at the individual level, super interesting and informative. But when we're looking at, like, we had 111 dogs and people come in for just my master's, the in-person portion.
Wow, that is a lot of data to work with.
A lot of data. And the pups, we had, like, over 600.
Wow.
Yeah, so with looking at that, that's really interesting as a generalizable population just in Kingston. What are the tendencies and can we group those, right? Say, like, around this one particular point in time, when we kind of code, we don't really see those things. We can kind of decipher, like, a relationship, but visually seeing, oh, 40% of our sample that is real, that 40% that when we look at pups, like, they're super anxious. In the first 20 seconds, they actually don't even let their dog, like, sniff anything, for example. That's just a super, like, extreme example.
Or, like, what you could see or what themes you could pull out from that visual.
Exactly. Oh, yeah. Yeah, which is cool.
Well, and that would, I mean, I guess it'll have to, you'll have to wait and see what the method reveals to you, but that could tell you a lot of different things to move forward with.
It's kind of tangential, but even with this type of research, there's so many different, like, ways to analyze it. Mm-hmm. Like, what we kind of did was looking at basically just behavior. We're looking at coding it on a continuous scale. But I'm really interested in looking at people's voice changes and how much, like, they even gender their dog. There was so many different versions of people that actually were way... their people that had their dogs that were more attentive to them used gendered language towards their dogs.
Oh, interesting.
And just, like, super random finding that, like, could be its own study, like, which is cool, too.
Well, it sounds like you have a lot of really rich, robust data just from your previous work, and then you're about to build on this as well and build this really new kind of novel data set. Well, sets of data, I guess, not even just one, but all these sets of data to be able to work with into the future as well, hopefully, and other folks as well.
Yeah, we're really excited about that. I think, too, like, a lot of this work prior has been really informative, but not necessarily super naturalistic, which has been a critique of, like, just impulsivity research with dogs, but also how do you sort of decipher, like, what impulsivity is, right? Like, it could be, like, is my dog super reactive and jumpy? Or, like, is my dog, is it only around squirrels, like, food? How much can you contextualize it to help somebody understand their dog better? And the kind of the implications of this, too, are, like, a lot of dogs were adopted during the pandemic, but a lot were relinquished right when people were starting to go back to work. Because behaviorally, they were, like, a huge change happened between everybody's lives. And they kind of got this companion animal thinking that this would be a good relationship. And then when behavioral things started coming up, when people got more social, a lot of people, there's, like, millions of dogs that got relinquished across North America.
Yeah.
So there's also, like, implications just for people to better be more responsible dog owners, but also, like, be more cognizant about that relationship with the animal when we decide to take it into our care as well.
Well, and of course, I mean, if you describe it, like, if you were to put a human in the context of a dog who was adopted during COVID, if you're like, oh, you met a new friend, they came to live with you as a roommate, and you spent 24/7 together during lockdown, and then suddenly you had to go back to work, but the roommate was no longer able to interact with you or anyone else while you were gone all day at work.
Yeah.
Of course, there'll be behavioral changes. And then if you, you know, apply that back to a dog, of course, it makes sense that there's lots. I mean, that's earth-shattering for the dog, right?
Even, so, like, breed-wise, right? Like, some people think, like, oh, I got this dog because it's really cute. But, like, that breed was made to be, like, chasing sheep 24/7 out on, like, 17 acres of land in Scotland, right? Like, it's a really specific way of, like, viewing a dog. But all those things, context-wise, are so important to understanding our dog's behavior.
Yes, much more than cuteness. So.
Exactly.
So how do you think this research could eventually support everyday dog owners with companion animals or professionals with working dogs?
Yeah, I think a main thing I really wanted to look at for my master's was, like, removing the potential label of a problematic dog, especially when their guardian or owner is a person that you could tell just when people would come in, sometimes they'd be like, oh, my dog is, like, so poorly trained. And then you sort of watch them interacting and it's like, you don't really give your dog a chance sometimes too. And also it's usually like, it's a two-way street. Like they say, like, there's a really interesting paper that is like stress runs from both sides of the leash. Like dogs tend to be like quite big mirrors, even like physiologically, like with cortisol, stress, anxiety, depression. Like I think to better inform people to understand that like dogs are really intertwined in our lives, probably more than we even notice, because it's one of those things like when you haven't seen somebody for a long time, you're like, you look different. Like when you're living with them all the time, it's a completely different relationship. But the idea, especially with pups, was looking at like a more context-based measure of, can we pinpoint those pain areas? Is there a way to better perform like a very quick and dirty version of what's your issues? And then can we train that way? Can we help you feel more confident, right? Because ultimately, we're just looking at beliefs and how beliefs affect behavior. And it shouldn't be that big of a deal, but obviously, given our current political climate and how the world is, I think it's a very interesting time to look at how much do we believe and how does that impact how we act, right? And like, I can say one thing, but the next day I can do a completely different thing, right? Those things don't really always, they're not always set in stone. So I think researching how we believe and what we think about our animals is really important to inform how to actually train them. And that's kind of the idea of like bridging science with also like everyday pet ownership.
Oh, that's really interesting. And it's, I don't know, this is totally anecdotal from my personal experience, but I like dogs. I don't have it my own dog, but I'm not good at setting boundaries with dogs. And I find that my friend's dogs know that immediately, and they will push, they'll put, you know, if they're, for example, if a dog isn't supposed to jump on someone and they know that, well, they come to me, they jump on me right away because they know I'm not going to stop them, right? Like, I'm like, oh, you're so cute, you know, so they push the boundary because they get a sense right away that my belief about them is that it's okay and I'm not going to, like, maybe, I don't know, punish or, you know, stop that behavior is the same thing. So dogs usually push limits with me that they wouldn't with their owners, because I think they can sense right away that I'm the weakest link.
Or the best one, right? Yeah, it's totally, and it's like, that's the thing, it's totally based up to perception. Like somebody, there's a really interesting paper that kind of, I would say like it inspired this work and then we took it a totally different direction, but it was the first paper to look at pet parenting styles developed from human developmental parenting styles and looking at those differences in that relationship. I think they've only used it in one population, so again, replication crisis, take everything with a grain of salt, but they've basically found like there are patterns across there are patterns across, like, if I'm authoritarian, how much my dog actually problem solves or like persists in a certain situation. Like things that I think when we talk about them may be more intuitive. But if I were to say, like, across the three different parenting styles, which do you think your dog would persist more? I don't think people would really know, right? So there's even how we tend to like own and like have this sort of power over the animal. Like it's definitely not, there's a power imbalance in that relationship. It's pretty interesting to think about, like, even how we say that we're acting and what we believe to be the case with parenting styles. It's kind of the same thing. Like, I think some people may say they're more authoritative but end up being more authoritarian or permissive, for example. And it's totally up to that person's belief.
Oh, right. That's very, yeah. Well, I guess in the case of my friend's dogs, I am certainly a permissive permissive guardian in when I visit with friend's dogs, because, yes, they get away with it.
Yeah. That's awesome.
And so you're doing all of this really incredible work. And I know on top of that, you also keep really busy outside of the lab. Can you tell us a little bit about the textbook that you developed and what that was all about?
Yeah, definitely. So huge shout out to Dr. Megan Norris. She is the best. She's the undergraduate chair of psychology. She runs a course in fourth year for students. So you get the opportunity to TA Psych 100, which is awesome. But at the same time, she really challenges you in her whole sort of, there's an exam, but the main project through the course of the course is solving an issue with education.
Okay.
Super broad, right? It can be super daunting. But she really guides you in a way that, like, you think a lot, quite deeply about, like, what are some issues in education. And it could be higher education, it could be elementary. But with our group, we were like, okay, let's just go talk to people first. And we talked to a bunch of students. And we surveyed 500 students on Queen's campus. And again, this is quite a privileged institution. Like, and still, like, the main pain point of every single student was money, paying for school across Canada. So when we realized that, we were looking into, like, okay, what are the ways that people can get money and funding? And we found that millions of dollars of scholarship money goes unclaimed every single year due to a lack of applicants. And there's just money that's left on the table. So our solution there was creating a free open access textbook that we wrote, and each chapter basically walks you through, like, how to get a scholarship, how to do it safely, what are the aspects of applying to higher education that are beneficial to you, and how can you interact with that in a way that you can feel empowered. And we, each chapter has been expertly reviewed by somebody in that field, so it's like completely peer reviewed, and it's actually been published on the Queen's, so we have an ISBN, so it's a formally published resource. And through that, we have won the National Financial Literacy of Canada's month. It's, they have a competition for students every year, but it was actually published on canada.ca too. That went into it. So a lot of it, we've had tens of thousands of people interact with the textbook, which is amazing. And we get people saying, like, I never thought I could go to school and I got a scholarship and it's changed my outlook on life.
Wow.
Like, it's very awesome. So I feel very, very privileged to be a part of that. But it's a very, very awesome thing that I always, push, because it's called how to pay for post-secondary. And it's through the eCampus project as well. So it's also like, there's interactives. It's a fun, we have fun videos in there. Yeah. So it's awesome.
So if someone were to Google how to pay for post-secondary, that resource would come up from eCampus Ontario, and that's where to go. Oh, wow. Well, that is incredible. And that, what an impact, both through your research, but just through your advocacy your team came up with. And that's all before you even started grad school. That's incredible.
Yes, thank you. Yeah, it was the same time as my undergraduate thesis that I was writing. So a lot of writing, big writing here. But yeah, I feel like it's the gift that keeps giving, which is really awesome.
Yeah, no, I will definitely, I think I have seen this resource before, and I will definitely search it out now to share that with other folks when questions come in, because that is such a helpful thing. And like you said, like, you don't want to leave money on the table. But at the same time, if you are maybe a high school student or a mature student looking to come back to school, you don't know what you don't know. So until you're already here, how would you know about all these opportunities and scholarships and fellowships that could be relevant to you?
I think the other thing too, like, you totally hit the nail on the head there with, like, so many people that I would say, like, really merit and should feel that way do not have that self-confidence. So a lot of the work that we were doing in terms of, like, writing to actually empower students, because, like, some of these people, like, they've invented the soup kitchen. You look at their resume and you're like, how have you never applied to anything? Like, you're a superstar. One of my co-authors has this really funny way of, like, describing, like, don't say you're a cashier, like, say that you managed, like, the funds of a multi-million dollar corporation, you know? Like, which is, like, it's, like, we're totally swinging the extreme of that, but it's a good way to perceive it, where, like, you have developed so many skills in your life, and why not you know, like, totally reframe that. So that's a big part of the textbook as well, that I think more people should feel. And it's weird, like, people don't really talk about finances. It's kind of a sticky topic. I think generationally we're doing a little bit better in terms of, like, with social media and things like that, but it still is this uphill battle that, like, especially for intersectionality, like, women, like, a lot of groups that have never really seen people that have been successful in that. So we're currently collecting, like, it's kind of like snapshots from people that have won scholarships but represent a minority group. So we have different, basically, chapters that are coming out that are more like, this person looks like you. They've been able to do this. Like, feel empowered by that. Because, again, like, I understand my own intersectionality, and, like, we want to uplift people that haven't seen people from their group or identity, which are totally out there. But we need to give them the microphone, you know?
Yeah, no, of course. And I think another, like, this theme keeps coming through your work about, like, belief, right? Of, like, what people self-perception or their belief about themselves, that kind of where that belief is can either limit or open up opportunities for them. So it sounds like your textbook with your co-authors is about getting people to believe in themselves a little bit more while still showing them scholarship opportunities and things like that, but building that belief in so that they'll actually, you know, take that leap and apply and then hopefully find success.
Totally. Yeah. And like really reframing whatever we think about ourselves to like, I think especially like these places want you to succeed.
Mm-hmm.
That's why they have it. So if you think that you don't merit it, like it's really you're your biggest obstacle in this case. Mm. Worst case is that you don't get it.
Mm-hmm.
But like it's totally spaghetti at the wall in this world, you know? Like it's kind of the same with research. Like the amount of times that you'll think like, oh, this is going to be something that's super significant. And then there's a totally different tangential thing. But you did the work to get there.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the first step is always the most difficult. But the main thing people say is like, oh, like starting where I started, I feel better about myself even. Mm. Even if you don't get the first couple, like there's so many other opportunities to practice talking about yourself in a way that you're like, you're selling yourself and like, having you're convincing yourself too that you merit that opportunity, which I think is really, really awesome.
No, that's super cool. So we'll have to get people to check that out, check out the resource, and see what options could be available to you.
Mm-hmm.
Hannah, it has been great chatting with you. Thank you for doing the show and the best of luck with the rest of your research.
Amazing. Thank you so much for having me.
So that's it, everyone. Another week of Grad Chat comes to an end. Don't forget, you can download this show tomorrow from